Welcome to Acro Interview. I'm Mike, your host, and this podcast is with Neil Farrell. Neil chats about flying the Wessex, E3 Century, and the BBMF Dakota and Lancaster. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/Acro Interview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. Also, visit us at acrointerview.tv to watch all of our other interviews and sign up to our newsletter. Thank you and enjoy. Interested in aviation?
From a very young age. I grew up around airplanes, really. My father was an engineer in the RAF many years ago on Victors and Nats and a few other things as well. And I became aware of airplanes when we were out in Germany. My father was an engineer for an airline, so I kind of always grew up around airplanes.
When did you decide you wanted to join the Air Force?
When I was going through high school, really, I decided that was probably the best route to get to varied and interesting aircraft. And I thought that the Air Force was certainly the thing I wanted to do first.
So what year did you join?
I joined after doing my degree in 96.
So when did your training begin?
Initial officer training in 96, and then I was streamed helicopters. And I went to Shawbury in 98 to 99. I got my wings in April 99.
So can you explain some of the aircraft you flew on?
From the very beginning, I actually did my elementary flying training on the Bulldog, which has been replaced these days by the Tutor. After the Bulldog at Shawbury, it was the Squirrel single-engine helicopter, and then we progressed to the twin-engine Griffin, the latter-day version of the old Huey. And I got my wings on that and then went straight to Northern Ireland on the Wessex.
So did you want to be streamed to rotary?
It wasn't my first choice, actually. No, I wanted to be a heavy aircraft man, but as is the way of the Air Force, they send you where they need you a lot of the time. Although it wasn't my first choice, when I got there, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So can you explain some of the rotary training, what you had to go through?
Your first stages was really, you know, day one of helicopter flying is the hover and, you know, slow taxi and basic circuits, landing and taking off, that sort of thing. Once you'd learnt to fly the single engine Squirrel, you then moved on to the advanced phase of single engine, which was navigation, instrument flying, confined area, takeoff and landings in between, you know, rows of trees and what have you. Once you mastered that, you then moved on to the Griffin, and it was more of the same really, but there was a lot more emphasis on working with a team. So you had someone else in the other seat, and you also had a crewman down the back, and it was all getting you geared up for frontline operations. So you're flying bigger, more powerful, heavier helicopters, a lot more emphasis on navigation, a bit of formation flying, tactical formation flying, and there was also a search and rescue element in there as well, in case you ended up flying the Seeking.
Neil chats about flying the Wessex. So after this, you were posted to Wessex. How did this come about?
I came top of my course at Shawbury, which I was delighted with, and I got the choice I wanted, which was the Seeking on search and rescue. I actually wanted to do that. But again, the Air Force being what it is, they send you where they need you, and they were short of guys on the Wessex in Northern Ireland. So unfortunately, I got re-rolled to 72 Squadron.
How much training was involved to fly the Wessex?
It was another six-month operational conversion unit, although it was operational conversion flight. It was a flight within 72 Squadron. As I remember it, it was about 6 months, maybe four to six months, but it was all training done in theatre. You had a little bit of training on the UK mainland, which was, you know, learning how to start it up and do very basic flying with it. Then you very quickly progressed with frontline crews in Northern Ireland to do your training pretty much on the job.
So how was it different from the training aircraft you flew?
A lot older. It could physically fly as fast as the Griffin, and it could lift more, but because you were always loading it up full of troops and what have you, it was a lot more of a challenge to fly. A lot of fun when it was empty and nice and light, very manoeuvrable helicopter, but as soon as you put any payload on, it could bite you.
So could you explain some of the good points and bad points of the Wessex?
Wessex, the good points, its charm. I mean, it was lovely to fly a 35, nearly 40-year-old helicopter. And it was, you know, it was a handful at times, but when it was nice and light, it was a pilot's helicopter. It really was a lot of fun. Bad points, it was underpowered. I mean, the engines were very powerful, but the transmission was the limiting factor in it. So although the engines had a lot more to give, you were limited by the gearbox. And that was it, really. I mean, it was fun to fly. It was a challenge when it was heavy. But I wouldn't change it for the world.
How many people were crewed in it?
Normally a three-man crew. A pilot, another pilot in the other seat or navigator. They were basically doing the mission. They were running the mission, basically, doing the navigation and running the task sheet, telling you where to go next, basically, what the next event was. Crewman down the back was your eyes and ears around the helicopter in confined spaces. And, of course, he looked after all the troops down the back.
So can you tell us how long it took to plan a mission or a training sort of thing?
Not long at all, really, because you got to know the province very well. You knew how to get from A to B without any real big assistance from a navigator or the other guy. You knew which way you were to point the helicopter. You knew most of the forts and the helicopter landing sites. The only thing you really had to put much thought into was A, the weather, and how much fuel to put on for that first stint, because you didn't want to end up getting into a field too heavy to pick up the troops. So you had to balance how much fuel you put on versus how much you were going to lift when you got to where you were going. I'd say about an hour's planning, because it was just a task sheet telling you what you had to do that day. So once you realised you'd had the good weather, you could just go off and crack on with it.
So what was the main role of the Wessex? What was it actually designed for?
Back in the day, the Navy had shipborne variants of the same aircraft. So they were early days, they were used for ASW with the Navy, of course, for their own search and rescue. And we used them for the same as well, search and rescue and support helicopters.
So what squadrons were you based with the Wessex?
In Northern Ireland, it was 72 Squadron, and we were quite a good squadron, actually. We had Wessex and Pumas, I only flew the Wessex. And after 72 Squadron folded in 2002 in Northern Ireland, I was lucky enough to go to Cyprus and fly the Wessex for one more year in search and rescue duties.
Can you tell us a bit about your Northern Ireland tour?
Great fun. Everyone always says you should enjoy your first tour, and I did. I missed the helicopter. I missed the guys you flew with. The flying was varied, day and night operations, moving troops and the IUC as it was then, to all corners of Northern Ireland, all weathers, moving troops and underslung loads, in and out of all the hot spots that you hear about and read about in the papers. It was good fun.
How often did you fly?
Pretty much every day. If you had a down day, it was either due to weather, serviceability, or you were coming off nights and getting ready for a day shift, so you needed your rest. Good serviceability rate, and we had quite a few of them to pick and choose from. So if one did fall over in terms of serviceability, you could pick another one. I got a lot of hours in that first tour in very short time. It was good.
Was there such a thing as an average mission over there?
No, I don't think there's such a thing as an average mission in the Air Force, period, even though we strive for it. It was busy, and although you were doing the same sort of thing, i.e. you were moving troops from A to B, that's where the mundaneness ended. It was always a different field, always a different fort, always different weather. And like I said, the challenge with this aircraft was if it was heavy, it could bite you. So if you were in bad weather and heavy, you had your work cut out.
Have you got any memorable stories from Northern Ireland?
None that I can talk about in this interview.
So after 72 Squadron, what happened next?
Wessex in Northern Ireland, 72, we said goodbye to it. I remember dropping them off, one of them off, at RAF Shawbury. And then I went back to Valley to do a very short training module on search and rescue before going out to Cyprus to fly the Wessex for one more year on 84 Squadron.
What was that like?
People always think, oh, Cyprus, sunshine, great, you know, what a great tour. And it really was. It was lovely weather, and I loved the aircraft. I really didn't want to say goodbye to it, and I knew that the day was coming when I was going to say goodbye to it. But compared with the day-in, day-out, high-tempo, difficult flying of Northern Ireland, Cyprus was very much a more relaxed tour. You weren't moving troops day and night, you weren't battling with weather. It was very much nice blue skies, calm winds, and hovering over boats and cliffs, which was lovely. It was great fun, but it wasn't the sort of high tempo that Northern Ireland was. Mm-hmm. The thing I enjoyed most about both those tours was working on night vision goggles. That was good fun.
So could you tell us what happened after you finished your helicopter tours?
Well, I was unsure what was going to happen to me, really. I was looking forward to going to the Sea King back in the UK, but literally an off-the-cuff comment to my posting officer about becoming a fixed-wing instructor, he jumped on it. So, is that what you want to do? So before I knew it, I was posted back to the UK on the tutor course to become a qualified flying instructor.
Did you enjoy this?
Loved it. It was different. And what I've been lucky to do in my career is fly different airplanes every few years. I wouldn't change that at all. So I did enjoy it. I realised I enjoyed instructing, and I had 5 great years on the tutor.
Could you walk us through a typical day on the tutor?
In good weather, it was about 3 sorties a day, and you had overlapping courses. So it was pretty much a straightforward in the morning, met brief, grab your first student, do a board brief on what you were going to teach him that day, him or her that day, fly it, quick debrief, write up and repeat the whole process again for a different student. And because you had overlapping courses, it could be a very early sortie, effects of controls, something very basic, right up to formation and low-level navigation for the next two. So again, it was a very varied day.
What was it like to fly?
People describe it as trying to land a crisp packet in high winds. Very light. Compared with this, completely different. You know, notwithstanding it's an airplane and that's a helicopter, it was... this was quite solid, robust. Tutor was quite light. But once you got the hang of it and the picture out the front of what trying to land it looks like, it was straightforward. It was a good training vehicle.
So was it hard to retrain on a fixed-wing aircraft?
No, because if you think about it, we'd all flown single-engine pistoned aircraft right at the start of our careers. So I'd learned on the Bulldog, and the tutor replaced it. So you kind of got that skill anyway. And once you'd done frontline operations, going back to a very simple elementary training vehicle was quite straightforward.
Here, Neil chats about flying the E3 Century AWACS.
So after the tutor, you re-rolled in something. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be re-rolled into the heavy aircraft world, which is where I was always trying to get to, really, onto the Boeing E3D Century.
Was this out of choice or was it an option for you?
Out of choice. That was the jet I wanted to go to.
So when did your training start on the E3?
After a short stint at Cranwell on the King Air to get me used to the multi-engine way of doing things, I started the back end of 2008 on the Century.
So could you tell us about the training on the E3? What happened? What was it like?
Yeah, again, it was another 6 months of training. Good 3 or 4 weeks in the classroom. It's quite a complicated airplane. Still one of the last airplanes in the RAF that's got a flight engineer. There's very little automation, so you're learning about all the systems and how to interact with the flight engineer in the classroom first. And then there's about 20, 21 simulator sessions to go into to get you used to it. And then you get live on the real airplane. We did about 5 what we call P sorties, pilot training sorties, getting you used to how to fly the airplane, take off, landing, the important bits, instrument rating. And then you'd move on to the mission profile where you start flying with the mission crew. They're on the same course with you. And you all graduate together, so it's about a 6-month process.
Was it difficult coming from rotary and then obviously a light aircraft?
Very difficult. Century's quite a handful. Old technology. It's fly-by-wire in the old tradition. It's an actual cable that you're moving, rather than the more sophisticated electronic large aircraft that we have today. You're also moving tabs on the wing rather than straight to a hydraulic motor. So you're moving a tab which moves the aileron eventually. It's quite heavy to fly. It's not very intuitive. There's no sort of seat of the pads feel either. And when it's heavy, it's like at the Wessex, when it's heavy, it's a real handful.
Could you tell us, if you can, about the sim? What was it like?
The sim?
Yeah.
Sim's quite good, actually. It's not 100% like the airplane. It's good enough though. It's a very good procedural trainer because all the lights and whistles work with regards to, you know, the flying part and also the flight engineer's panel. And he is quite an involved man on that flight deck. He's your technical brains and your performance expert as well. So it's a very good training platform for him and for you to learn his problems and how to work with him. So I would say by the time we'd finished the simulators, we were ready to get in the airplane. And those simulators we still use today, pretty much every other week, just to keep our hand in.
So could you tell us about your first flight in it?
Yeah, I remember it very well, actually. First time I landed an aircraft that big on the runway, I was amazed I could do it. It was with a lot of relief as well. But there was no time to relax because it just got harder and harder. You know, the first sorties you do are generally in good weather. And after that, they don't wrap you in cotton wool so much, so it becomes more of a challenge. But yeah, I remember it very well. It was good.
So how many crew were in the E3?
On a pilot training trip, bare minimum, just a flight deck crew and a few guys down the back just to make sure nothing happens down the back untoward on a mission, anywhere between 14 to 18 routinely. All depends on the mission profile.
So was it is it an analogue cockpit or is it all glass?
It's a mixture. It's started off as an analogue flight deck, and over the years they've tried to upgrade it and put some glass bits and pieces in here and there. But by and large, it is 50s, 60s technology with a few modern add-ons.
So when you went from training and you actually got in the cockpit, was it difficult, or did it come naturally, all the switches and buttons and what have you?
Because of all the 20 or so simulator sessions we'd done, and each of those simulator sessions are 4 hours long.
Wow.
Exactly. So you do get to learn the cockpit quite well.
So when you first got in, it wasn't that you weren't a bit nervous, scared?
Other than hurting the aeroplane, damaging it, looking a fool, no.
So could you tell us what squadron you were based with?
8 squadron. I'm now an instructor on 54 squadron.
How many squadrons are there on the E3?
It's just the two. Was 3 at the time, but 23 disbanded a few years ago. And I'm not sure whether we're going to bring it back to life again.
So what is the main role of the E3?
Airborne early warning and control of the skies.
So you're kind of eye of the sky?
Eyes and ears.
So what type of aircraft is it? What's it based on?
It's an aircraft in its own right. They're not converted airliners, but it's loosely based around the old Boeing 707-300.
What kind of engines do they have?
CFM56, and they're quite a tough unit, actually. They're a good part of the airplane, shall we say.
So when, like, how long was it after your training ended that you became operational?
You come out of the conversion unit, what they call limited combat ready, and then they're looking for you to get combat ready within the next 6 to 9 months. So a lot of self-study going on, learning about what happens down the back of the airplane, enhancing your knowledge of the aircraft itself, several simulator sessions, and then once you've had a bit of exposure to operations or exercises, you're deemed combat ready.
So how does it actually handle? Does it fly well?
No. Like I say, it's a right handful. There's a lot of satisfaction in flying the Century, because when you do pull off a good landing, or more importantly as an instructor, you teach someone else to be able to do that well, it's an enormous sense of satisfaction. But it's not an easy airplane at all.
So can you tell us your role as the pilot? Is that just your main focus, or do you have other jobs?
As the captain, you are kind of the linchpin to make sure to pull in all the information you can get from all your experts around you. You don't have the loudest speaking part by any means. You allow all the other experts in the airplane to do their bits and pieces, particularly the flight engineer. And once you've got all the information you need, you make the decisions.
So could you talk us through the flight deck? How big is it, and is it comfortable?
Well, you would think being a Boeing, it's huge, but it's not. If you think about what it was derived from, it was supposed to be an airliner, so any cockpit room that's free is wasted. It's seats that could be taken up, space that could be taken up by seats for fare-paying passengers. So actually, the 707, if you like, cockpit is quite cramped. Never forget, there's 4 of us in it, plus a jump seat, so it's quite small.
Is it a reliable aircraft?
Yes and no. It's getting on a bit now, bless it. It's actually a really good piece of equipment when it's all up and running. And, you know, there's a lot of satisfaction to getting an airborne, doing a mission and landing. It just requires a lot of TLC these days.
So how often would you fly in a week?
There's no typical week, really, particularly as an instructor, because my flying comes in fits and starts. So at the moment, I'm training a new course. We're at the simulator phase. And the pilot training flights will come later on, and they can come thick and fast. So you could have 2 or 3 flights in 1 week, and then the mission phase will start, maybe 1 to 2 flights in that week as well. All depends on weather and other priorities, because the frontline squadron needs these aircraft as well. So there's a bit of a bum fight sometimes.
Well, so where are they actually based?
RAF Waddington.
And how many aircraft are there?
We've got 6. Okay, the average sort of mission, if there is such a thing, let's pretend we're not on a conflict anywhere, it's just a UK standard training sortie. You tend to get together the day before with your flight engineer and get a weather report to work out how much fuel you can get on board. Again, he's your performance expert, so you'd look to him for his advice and what numbers he comes out with. The other guy that you liaise with really is what we call the tactical director, and he's the main guy down the back of the aircraft running all the mission crew. So you'd see what needs he has, why he wants to get airborne, where he wants to go, and how long he wants to be wherever you want to go in the UK. Once you've got all his inputs, and you've got the inputs from the flight engineers to what we can achieve, you come up with a plan. So you do that the day before, and the morning of the day, normally about 3 hours before takeoff, you'd all come in, get an update for the weather, see if anything's changed from the tactical director's point of view, his needs, whether you want to get airborne earlier or later. Earlier is a challenge, later is not a problem. Other than that, people do their jobs. Co-pilot will make sure you've got the charts you need. Navigator will file the flight plan, check all the NOTAMs and the usual stuff. The mission crew down the back, they make sure they've got all the facts they need for their job to do in the air. Whoever they're going to be controlling, they'll liaise with them before they get airborne. And then you will gradually all filter out to the jet and get airborne.
Can the E3 mid-air refuel?
It can. It's I think the only aircraft in the RAF inventory that can refuel through both different means, probe and drogue and boom. So it's quite versatile.
Do you ever go on training exercises abroad?
Yeah, in fact, a lot of what we do are exercises abroad, yeah.
So what other nations do you work with?
Pretty much all the NATO ones, all the NATO countries. I mean, we're largely a NATO asset. Our call sign is a NATO call sign. So, yeah, we work with all the usual partners.
So on an average mission or training sortie, what kind of aircraft would you interact with?
Mostly in the UK, the boys down the back are controlling with the Typhoons. But we could easily move across the continent and train with other aircraft in Europe.
So, I don't know if you'd like to tell us this, but how long can you stay airborne for?
All depends on how much fuel you can get on board. But, I mean, with air-to-air refueling, we can be airborne for into the teens, let's put it that way.
Have you ever been deployed operationally?
Yes.
Can you talk us through that?
I can let you know where we went. We've done operations over Afghanistan, and I've done operations over Libya as well.
Did all your training prepare you for that?
Yes, it did. Yeah.
So, do you have any memorable stories in the E3 that you could share with us?
I suppose my most memorable one was the longest flight I did, which was just under 16 hours.
Oh, God.
Exactly. At the end of that, you're a different person. A lot more grumpy than I am now. So I think that was my biggest memory. I think other little firsts that you do as well. I mean, the first time I went air-to-air refueling, you know, you remember those sorts, because it's quite hard to get two big old Boeings together in the same bit of sky touching. It's quite something.
So how long do you have to train for refueling?
Yes, was that? It's a separate skill altogether.
So how long did that take you to, I don't know, you can say master, but...
I did it a couple of years ago, got the qualification, but sadly, because I'm an instructor in the UK, I'm not as operational as I used to be, so there isn't the need for me to keep that skill set up like there is for the frontline crews. Classroom work, a good week in the classroom, a few simulator sessions to get used to the procedures, and then I would say typically 3 to 4 flights to get the qualification to do it. But it's one of those skills like landing the airplane, really, you need to keep on top of it. It is one that fades, and it's hard work.
So after your operational, you went to be an instructor. Could you tell us about this?
Yes. Because of my instructional background, the tutor, it was quite obvious, really, that I was inevitably going to be an instructor on the Sentry. I became an instructor on 8 Squadron, so I did a bit of instructing or requalifying of the frontline crews before then moving to the school where I taught guys for the first time that had ever been on the Sentry how to fly.
Is it like a pass-fail thing, or does usually most pilots pass?
By the time they've got to the OCU, guys are going to pass. That said, it's difficult, and some guys have the odd hiccup here and there, but we're not as cut and dry in the military. We've invested a lot of time in people, and people have invested a lot of time in their life in the military at that stage, to then suddenly fail because of 1 or 2 bad trips. So if someone does have a bad day and doesn't quite achieve the aim, there's a system in place to give them more training to achieve it, and then we'll review it after that. So I wouldn't say we're touchy-feely and wrap people in cotton wool, but we certainly give everyone the opportunity to flourish.
So do you instruct on a daily basis?
Yes, I would say I would, either in the classroom, in the simulator, or in the aeroplane. Yeah, that's my main job, is to instruct these.
Do you enjoy this?
I love it, actually. Having spent 5 years on the tutor, I knew that I did enjoy instructing.
Neil chats about flying the Dakota and the Lancaster for the BBMF.
So in 2014, something special happened. Could you tell us about this?
It did, yes. I was lucky enough to be selected to fly on the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
How did this come about?
It was something I always had my eye on, but as you can imagine, flying these lovely old airplanes, you need a certain background and experience level. So once I'd achieved that, the process is to write a letter to the boss. I said, I'd like to join your display team, and these are the reasons why. after that, it's similar to the Red Arrows in that they sift all those that apply. It tends to be a social, so everyone gets to be met in a social environment, and then the interviews start the next day. Then from those interviews, they'll pick the lucky candidate. And in 2014, it was me.
So did you apply for to fly anything, or did you want a specific type?
Because of my background, which is heavy aircraft, I'm only eligible to fly for the Lancaster and Dakota. So the Spitfire and Hurricane flyers tend to come from a fast jet background, which kind of makes sense.
So could you tell us, once you got accepted, when your training started and what was it like?
Got accepted, I think it was the February, and then the training started pretty much the next month. Starts off with a lot of ground school on the Dakota, first of all. You start off on the Dakota. March through to April, you do all your flying training. And once you've gone solo, for want of a better word, once you've flown the aircraft as captain, you'll then start your display work up. And then come the end of April, you have what we call the PDA, public display approval, in front of a high-ranking officer, and that's you then eligible to display that airplane for that summer.
So could you talk us through what it was like to fly the Dakota?
Fantastic. I can remember, there's very few flights that you remember, and that's one of them. And I can remember once my instructor got out, and I was off to do my first flight as captain, turned to my entire crew and saying, whatever happens, do not let me cop this up. And we did about half an hour flying circuits and bumps at Collinsby. Fabulous day.
What was it like to fly? What's the characteristics like?
It's a tail dragger, so again, it'll bite you. Things with tail draggers is you've got to land them straight. If you land them slightly off to one side, they can swap ends. And at 90 knots, or touchdown, about 80 knots really, at 80 knots, if you get that wrong and it swaps ends, you're going to hurt the airplane.
So how long would an average mission take? Like, how long would you fly for?
Beauty of the BBMF is, there's nothing routine about it. once you're in the throes of summer, there's actually very little displaying that you do in the Dakota. It tends to be fly paths, which is three fly paths of an event, three passes overhead, if you like. You can be airborne for as little as half an hour for a couple of local fly paths, or you can be airborne for 3 hours up and down the country, joining up a dozen fly paths. It's brilliant.
So how much planning does it take for, like, to join up with a lot of aircraft?
If you're doing an air show, you'll have a slot. So the navigator is one of the hardest working on these airplanes, mm-hmm. without a doubt. They'll be in the week before, the day before, planning, contacting all the event organisers. If you're doing a fly pass at an air show or a display, or even if you're doing a fly pass at a train museum or a school or something like that, you'll need to coordinate, and you'll be given a slot, a time when you're going to be there, plus or minus a few minutes. There'll also be contact on the day. There may even be a radio frequency. So it's all quite well planned. So on the day of the event, you know where you've got to be and when, and you should be able to deconflict with everyone else.
So does weather affect that quite a lot?
Hugely. These are priceless aviation artifacts. So you would have weather limits that were probably not the same as they had during the day, but you're trying to remove the risk of pranging these airplanes in strong winds or high crosswinds or low cloud. So yeah, we have set limits and we stick to them.
So where's the Dakota based?
RAF Coningsby with all the rest of the fleet.
So do you have any memorable air shows or fly paths in the Dakota?
Yes, I remember doing a fly path. We took the aircraft all the way to Holyhead. Exactly. it was a lovely day out. It was blue skies, calm winds. We flew at low level all the way to Holyhead for the Lifeboat Museum. And it was beautiful blue waters. We flew overhead RAF Valley to get to where we were going. And at Holyhead Lifeboat Museum, we did three passes, and it was full of people. And we brought the aircraft home through Snowdonia. And about a week later, we got a very nice thank you letter. That's a nice thing to get.
So it must feel like a privilege when you get to do stuff
like
that.
Huge privilege. Privilege to fly the airplanes. It's a privilege to meet the veterans. And it's a huge privilege to entertain all the people that come to the air shows.
You also fly the Lancaster as well. Can you tell us about this?
Wonderful airplane. And its majesty is not lost on you when you strap in. There's a little plaque on the back door that says remembering the many, so we get that little tap as we get in. Once you've learnt the Dakota, halfway through your first season, all being well, you'll learn to fly the Lancaster as a co-pilot. and it's the same routine, really. You are doing fly paths or air shows up and down the country, but the added bonus of the Lancaster is you display with the Hurricane Spitfire on your wing.
That's not bad, is it?
It's not bad at all.
So was the training different for the Lancaster?
The beauty about being the co-pilot in the Lancaster is you don't actually land the beast. You are kind of a throttles man. You're there to be another pair of eyes and ears. You might work the occasional radio. The navigator is the hardest working chap in the airplane, without a doubt. And then the captain when you come to land the beast, because then, once again, it's a tail dragger and it'll bite you on the ground. As a co-pilot, it's a lovely place to be, because you haven't got to worry about landing it. That little devil's always on your shoulder, you know, whispering in your ear. You've got to land it. But you do get to do the flypass, so you actually get to fly the airplane on the flypass. So it really is the best of both worlds.
So how many are crewed in the Lancaster?
Routinely four. There's the captain, me, the co-pilot, navigator, who's one of the hardest working in the airplane, and the flight engineer.
Is it the same crew every time?
No, mix and match all the time, as with the Dakota. Because we're all volunteers, for want of a better word, it's not our primary job to be on the BBMF. We still do our main job elsewhere. People come on an availability basis.
So could you tell us about your first time in the Lancaster? That must have been pretty special.
It was. Before you learn to fly it, you have a FAMIL flight, so that the wow factor is taken away for when you come to learn to fly it. And I did that sat in the upper turret. We did a fly pass down at High Wycombe, I think it was, for a dining in night. And again, it was a beautiful blue day, calm winds, and it was just us airborne, and it was lovely. I think it was about a 3-hour flight there and back. And I remember thinking in the upper turret, my God, these boys were very exposed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I remember that flight very well.
So what air shows have you flown in the Lancaster?
I've done Duxford, I've done Southport, Bournemouth, and I think that's about it. A lot of the other things I did in the Lancaster were flypasts.
So what's it like to fly? Like, could you tell us?
Very much like a Sentry.
Really?
It's quite solid, it's quite sturdy, and it doesn't want to roll particularly well. It's a bomber, so it needed to be quite stable and fly in a straight line while the bomber even did his bits and pieces. Yeah, it's a heavy old bird, actually.
So what's the cockpit like? Is it all analogue?
Very much so.
No modern systems
like
at all?
See in the movies. No, not at all. It's lovely. It's typically British.
Yeah. So what was the first time, can you remember, the first time you met up with a Spitfire and a Hurricane?
Yeah, I think it would have been towards the end of my first season. We did it was Bournemouth Air Show. We flew into Biggin Hill, and after that, the Spitfire and Hurricane joined us, and we went down to do Bournemouth. It was lovely.
That must have been special. Yeah,
it was.
So, could you tell us about the seasons? How many seasons do you get to fly?
When you join, it's kind of an unwritten contract, but they'd like a minimum of about 5 years out of you, 5 seasons, which I think is fair enough, because you're amassing a lot of corporate knowledge of how the air show world works. You get to know all the airfields that you work at, also, you know, the people that organise them, the flying display directors, a lot of things to pick up. 5 years is about right, because you can learn it, then you can pass it on to the next generation of guys that come to fly the airplanes. But you can do a lot longer. Some of the guys have been there 8-10 years.
So you're hoping to stay on for a few more seasons?
I would hope so. We'll see how it goes. At this stage of the display season, we've no idea what shows we're going to yet. We know some of the big ones, you know, like I was talking earlier, Duxford and Southport and what have you. We know that they've been requested. In terms of, do I know whether I'm going to be displaying there? Not yet. It's an evolving beast. Over winter, all the requests will come in from fly pass and major air show organisers for these airplanes to turn up. There's a very busy chap called Parky, who's the ops officer. He'll be putting together a spreadsheet with all these requests, and he'll be clumping them together on certain days. Geographically, he'll be putting them together in little pockets. Obviously, you won't want aircraft crisscrossing up and down the country. You'll send them all to one sort of area to get the job done on their own. So over winter, he'll come up with that plan, and then nearer the time, you'll fine-tune which aircraft and which crews are going to go and fly those to space.
So how often do you get to fly?
Again, there's no average.
No average?
You know, I would say every couple of weeks at the minimum throughout the display season. It can be quite full-on.
So you don't get to pick which aircraft they pick you?
The bomber leader, he does a really good job. He's a very busy man. He's training us all, he's keeping us all current, and he's allocating you to an aircraft throughout the season. What he tries to do is he tries to balance out the flying. So if the first part of the season one particular guy's got more hours than another guy, the other half you'll try and load them up.
Okay.
But don't forget, we're also flying frontline airplanes, so it may be that our frontline squadron wants a bit more of our time than we can give to BBMF, so you may lose out in that respect, but you know, it's a balancing act.
So frontline always comes first?
Yes, but in my mind, you know, you can't help it. You try and prioritise the BBMFs, it's such fun flying. But yeah, really, the frontline flying has to come first.
Do you have any memorable moments from flying the Lancaster?
Yeah, I think when my first season, when the Canadian Lancaster came across, we took the Lancaster to Jersey, and Vera, as the aircraft was called, joined us with the Spitfire and Hurricane. And I remember very well tracking out over the sea to Jersey and then coming back again. It was good. It was a sight you were not going to get bored of, looking at another Lancaster on your wingtip.
This could be a difficult one, but do you have a favourite out of the two?
Do you know what? I do. And people will be shouting at the screen now saying, Lancaster, Lancaster. It's not, it's the Dakota.
Really?
I know. I should say Lancaster, but it's Dakota. I can't explain why. Although I had a conversation with one of the fighter pilots a couple of seasons back about what his favourite was. And the fighter pilot boys, they fly the Hurricane first. And he's, of course, everyone would expect him to say, Spitfire's my favourite. But I think the first Warbird you fly, I think, well, for me, that's the reason it's my favourite, because it's the first Warbird I flew was the Dakota. And it'll always be the case, I think. Now, I'm not a captain on Lancaster yet. Maybe when I move into the left-hand seat, I'll think differently. But at the moment, it's the DAC, very special.
So, Neil, do you have any hobbies?
I am pretty busy. I would say flying is my hobby. I don't have much time for anything else, because in the summer season I'm current on three different airplanes, so there's not a lot of time for any hobbies.
Do you have a favourite tipple?
I could get whiskey these days as I'm getting greyer.
Favourite aircraft?
Of the ones I've flown or in the world?
In the world.
Do you know, I think I'm going to go back to the Dakota on that one. Yeah.
Dakota? One you could wish you could have flown?
Well, I wish I could have flown.
Yeah.
Yeah, Space Shuttle.
Space Shuttle? Wow, yeah. Never heard that one
well,
before.
Well, there you go.
You have a favourite place to display it?
I did Southport this year, which is quite close to home, and it was nice to be able to let all my friends and family know that I was coming for them to watch. And Southport's a nice venue, so yeah, Southport's good.
What's the best part for flying for the BBMF?
The fact that you are treading in the footsteps of some really, really amazing people, and you get to experience what they did.
Can we find you online anywhere?
I've not Googled myself, but I've no doubt you'll be able to find me on the BBMF website.
Do you have a Twitter account?
I do.
Do you want to mention? Do you know what it is?
It's NeilFarrell3, I think it is. You'll find me.
And finally, do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
Never. It's my life.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, you can watch and listen to all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, please sign up to our newsletter for exclusive content, prizes, upcoming interviews and much more. And of course, go over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us grow and to become part of the team for as little as $1 per month. Thank you and see you soon.